All right, it's a good afternoon, it's a good morning. Sorry, not a good afternoon, but good morning. You see, we are making mistakes because this is not our, this is not my hour. And because this is not my hour, I will make hourly mistake. But it's not really justifiable because every hour is an hour. Do you understand that? So it's not really justifiable to make mistakes because every hour is an hour. So, I'm in the middle of an hour. I'm in the middle of an hour. So, and I invite you to be part of the conversation. And this is, of course, morning scoop, early morning scoop. This is the early morning scoop. And I invite you to be part of the conversation. And today we are not just going to look at the coups that are taking place in that took place in Africa recently, but we are also going to look at the Kasinga Day, because today is the Kasinga Day, and 48 years ago, in a refugee camp. You know, filled with mostly women and children, and an armed man was attacked, according to history, by the South African, you know, South African forces. And it is said, that 600 people were killed and injured. So, and that is what is called the massacre, and that's the Kasinga massacre, or the Kasinga attack. It was a brutal attack by South Africa 48 years ago. So, and we're today, that's why it's a public holiday. And today, 4th of May, it's a public of holiday, 4th of May, 1978. That's what happened, that it took place in Angola, and they celebrate, the Namibia celebrates this every day, I mean every year, they commemorate the Kasinga Day. I'm sure that on the 28th of May there will be Genocide Day, 28th of May there will be Genocide Day, and of course the then the Namibian nation will be able to commemorate that as well. That is Genocide Day, I think 112 years ago. You know, von Trotta and others orchestrated the first genocide of the 20th century. That was done in Namibia. Right, so now we first of all just look at some stories. Just look at the Nigerian movie world, and which is done in, of course, vernacular. Struggling to pick up though, but having quite a number of. Having quite a number of viewership, if you like, you know, because you're talking about a language such as Hausa that is spoken by over 50% of Nigeria's population. So they are now practicing to make an economy out of movies that are made, are produced in vernacular local language or indigenous language, that are telling indigenous stories. And we'll meet the other side, but first of all, let's try to take a listen.
The Israeli military has issued new forced evacuation orders for towns and villages across southern Lebanon. Fighting is intensifying despite a ceasefire that came in.
But let's ask a question. After you marched and say you don't want Zimbabweans, you...
Action!
This is Kaniwood, the heart of northern Nigeria's film industry. Less famous than Nollywood, but far from small.
Here,
Akru films a story about banditry, a contemporary story that resonates well with the more than 120 million speakers of the Hausa language. But the industry struggles with huge challenges.
We were unable to make inroads into Netflix, Amazon Prime and other streaming platforms because of poor equipment and failing to meet other criteria.
On average, Kennewood releases 200 movies a month, with its audience stretching from Nigeria, across West and Central Africa and the diaspora. But exporting culture comes at a cost.
So the censorship board was very, very strict then, because when you don't bring it to them, those marketers will not buy. And if they buy any movie that is not censored, they can go and deal with them.
Now, a new generation is pushing boundaries, adding subtitles, experimenting with stronger storylines, and turning to regional streaming platforms.
A few years ago, piracy almost brought Kennewood to its knees. A lack of investment in equipment and manpower means the industry here is unable to compete with its southern cousin, Nollywood. But as streaming services reshape African cinema, Kennewood is beginning to reap the benefits.
Industry players say while investment is poor, ideas abound.
We have very good stories, and I'm so happy that people down south, the producers down south, we have international bodies that are coming to the north to tell our stories. It's a work of development, but how I wish we have somebody that will sponsor those stories. Because we've done so many projects, it's actually a house-oriented stories.
For Kennewood, this isn't just about films. It's about a cultural test, about whether conservative societies can tell their stories globally without losing who they are. Ahmed Idris, Al Jazeera, Kano, Nigeria.
All right, so sorry for the mix-up there with the inserts. Of course, it happens. It's technology. And it's also early morning. Don't worry. Don't worry too much. It's still early in the morning. But, we look at the indigenous importance of, you know, dramatizing indigenous stories so that when those stories are put into drama and there is you know, proper guidance in terms of, you know, how to, you know, in terms of scripting and, you know, equipment and manpower and skills, all skills put together, those indigenous stories can be told in a drama form to, you know, to this generation and also the coming generation. They will come and find those stories on social media and they'll be able to relate with what happened or what used to happen, how, you know, people lived their lives. Because 100 years from now, we are going to be ancient, you know. People are going to tell our stories. They are going to find our social media posts. They are going to find our, you know, social media, our shows. You know, they are going to find Eagle FM podcast. And they are going to understand, oh, so this is what used to happen in Namibia. This is a type of lifestyle Namibians lived 100 years ago, because we don't know much of the stories that were told 100 years ago. We know about the genocide. We know about other stories that were orally passed, you know, from one generation to the other. But we don't know. Because they are just oral. We don't have audios. We don't have visuals. Or, you know, and so on, to be able to see for ourselves and hear those voices for ourselves. So, but this the coming generation is so lucky that they will find something. They are going to find audios. They are going to find, you know, writings. They are going to find videos. Things are documented on platforms, and these platforms will transform, will be transferred. This information will be transferred from one platform to the other, depending on, you know, the technological development and innovations and evolution that, you know, will take place. So, and that is how people will understand that, oh, so maybe there'll be a change in language, vocabulary. People will understand to say, oh, so this is how people used to phrase words. This is how old language used to be like. Because 100 years back, our indigenous languages were not sounding the same they are sounding today. A lot have changed. We are mixing words, you know, we are borrowing a lot of words from English, from other languages. But 100 years ago, we didn't have that because coexistence was not as big.
Don't spend all you had in money. Get quality food at USAFE. 4 100-gram clover-flavored daily snacks. Just $20 Namibian for two. That's 8 100-gram cups. 2 liters Koi soft drinks. Only $12.99 each. 600 grams Hazeldine mixed fruit jam. $29.99. Knosu. Just $25 for 5 packets. Save $10. 700 grams Nola mayonnaise. $39.99. USAFE. Where good food costs less.
The views and opinions expressed by our guests and callers are not those of Eagle FM and any of its staff.
Wapumbwa Eva Tere ulikoni maondo toto ingida ashike kapeno nweku tete opoye ekukurile oshafa fana nongeshe faili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshuwana onongeshe faa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi tota njuka okukwetira oipindi konu konda doi nawa nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshe faa omarudi Dayo Loka, open Ujendi Fenawa, Nokumona Ojawiri Nawa, Ninge Pata Fanona, Monica, Ko, Eagle FM, Honora Tatime, Bali Heali, Nola Natu, Heali Bali No Heali, Ileko Berewa, Nora Hetatu Natu, Bali O Hetatu Watatu, Oma Felane, Eagle FM, the Eye.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
All right, we are back, and of course it's 6:30. We are still here. We still have 1 hour, 30 minutes together. And you don't need to worry about time because we have a lot to talk about. So we in our generation have borrowed a lot of words from, you know, other languages because of the massive coexistence that is taking place in our time, which did not take place in their time 100 years ago. So words were words. We have lost a lot of words, thousands of words on how we call certain things. We have lost them because when development came, things start to shift. People start to be urbanized. They start to mix, you know, languages. In Afrikaans, they started to mix Afrikaans, Portuguese, those who are close to Portuguese, English, and so forth. So, but the new generation will be able to learn to say, okay, so this is how this language used to sound. This is how they pronounced this word. So, and I would have wanted to hear how Oshiwamba used to be spoken or Silozi used to be spoken 200 years ago. But we don't have that information because there were no social media. And in fact, even English, we don't even have the audios. At least we have books like Shakespeare's, who writes in the old, you know, English, you know, words. And of course, those who read Bible, we have the King James version of thou, thee, that kind of English. That was the English of the 1611, you know. But we don't have any, from our own perspective, we don't have any audio and any visualized, you know, stories that would narrate our existence, you know, 100 years ago. So this Kannywood story of coming up with movies in Hausa, which is mainly spoken in the north of Nigeria by 120 million people, it's a big thing. But the challenges, of course, is piracy and lack of equipment, lack of, you know, compared to Nollywood, which is mostly, you know, in the south of Nigeria, and it is mostly, you know, people play movies in Yoruba, Igbo, in, you know, Calabar. They mostly are Christian, or at least they have, because most Hausas in the north are predominantly Muslims. And it is also, you know, maybe about the faith issue that, you know, the movie industry did not really kickstart in the north. But it is coming, and, you know, hope is that, you know, people will be able to tell indigenous stories, turn indigenous stories into drama that could both entertain and, of course, teach. Now we go to the sad news of course, Israel trying to expand itself in Lebanon and causing both economic and, you know, both economic and safety, you know, havoc in, of course, the northern Lebanon, or southern Lebanon, rather. So, and let's get to the story, and then we meet the other side.
The Israeli military has issued new forced evacuation orders for towns and villages across southern Lebanon. Fighting is intensifying despite a ceasefire that came into effect last month. Israeli forces say they have carried out strikes on 120 Hezbollah targets, but the impact is being felt far beyond those sites. The health ministry says 41 people were killed in a 24-hour period over the weekend. That's taken the total death toll since the beginning of March to more than 2,600. Well, most of the attacks have hit areas outside Israel's so-called yellow line. That military zone extends about 10 kilometers into Lebanese territory from the border. Israel is illegally occupying the area and has demolished towns and villages. We'll go to Rory Challens now, who is in Beirut for us. And Rory, more forced evacuation orders being issued by the Israeli military. How are people responding to these?
Well, the reality is that if the Israeli army tells you to leave your home, then you don't really have any choice. If you stay where you are, then you run the risk of being killed. The forced evacuations essentially work like this. The order comes in from the Israeli military, and people have sometimes as little as 15 minutes. Usually it's up to a couple of hours or so to pack up whatever they can and get out. And they have to retreat to at least 1 kilometer away from the village, from their homes. And then it's just a matter of waiting to watch the Israeli bombs do their work. And hopefully their homes will still be standing at the end of it. If they are, well, then it still doesn't mean that their community is safe to go back to. And if their homes are demolished, well, then they are automatically joining the ranks of, you know, a million or so Lebanese people who are displaced from their homes. The significance of these forced evacuation orders on Sunday is that yet again they show that Israel is expanding its area of operations. Three of these villages have not been given forced evacuation orders before. They are all north of the yellow line. Some of them are even north of the Litani River, which is the extent of the buffer zone that Israel says that it wants to create in southern Lebanon. A reminder that this is a country that's supposed to be in a state of some sort of ceasefire that was negotiated between or brokered by the United States between Israel and Lebanon back in the middle of April, extended to the middle of May. But the reality is that on the ground that ceasefire doesn't really exist. As a Chinese diplomat put it, it's a, more of a lesser fire than a ceasefire.
Mm.
Right, a lesser fire than a ceasefire. So, and one would wonder, where is the United Nations? Where is the international community? When other countries are being battered by one country that is, you know, one country in the Middle East going almost after everyone. And what is happening? What are the mistakes that were done in the past that are leading a new generation to continue to suffer in the hands of, you know, one regime that is busy destabilizing others. But for us to understand this, we need to go back to 1948. When Israel as a state came to being in the 1950s, especially they has that, you know, part of the world has already plunged into chaos. The first day Israel was declared to be a nation for the Jews, that is the day the Middle East, you know, imploded. The Middle East does not explode. The Middle East implodes. So which means it's an internal explosion. It's an internal blast. It implodes. So that caused an implosion of the Middle East. Okay, there were mistakes on both sides. Now, the mistake on the Jewish side was for them to say they only want a state for the Jews only. They don't want to mix with anyone. They only want their own state. Because other countries in the world, you have Saudi Arabia, for example, which is predominantly Arab. You have other countries that are predominantly Arabs. You have, you know, countries in Europe where people are predominantly one ethnic group. So the Jews also thought to say, no, look, we also want to have a country based on our ethnicity. We don't want to mix with anyone. Other people can come, but we don't want them to come and be the majority here. We want a Jewish state. And that is what, you know, led to others fighting for the land, the same land. And also, you know, connecting it to historical and religious, you know, past, you know, claims. Who owned the land, you know, because the Israels, this new state of Israel, you know, found people there in Palestine. So that's a historical argument which is correct. But where are these people coming from? Because they also found other people in that land before they occupied it in, you know, around 700 AD. So where are those people that were found around 700 AD? Who are those people? You know, those are the stories that are not mostly widely, you know, discussed. But they are very, very important for us to understand, you know, where we are coming from as far as this Israeli chaos in the Middle East is concerned. The mistake that the Arab nations and Arab, you know, I mean, Islamic religion made, or Islamic religious figures made, was to openly, you know, call for the annihilation of Israel, you know, to call for the wiping out of a nation called Israel. That was the most powerful mistake that is now resulting to Israel becoming a paranoia state and pariah state in that, on that level, you know, because they are going after everyone for their own security, because they understand that they are a small, you know, a small country among big 22, you know, Muslim world countries, 22 Islamic countries, 22 Arab countries, in fact, the 22 Arab countries. Now, here is where it becomes politically, you know, complicated and, in fact, logically cumbersome. You know, the issue is, now, how do you have 22 Arab countries, in fact, 22 Arab countries, and exclusively Islamic republics, okay? So Islamic kingdoms, and against one country that wants to be also identical or identified as a Jewish state. So it is correct for these 22 countries to declare themselves Islamic republics and Islamic kingdoms. That's number one, excluding everyone else out. And then, you know, not only that, predominantly Arab. In fact, excluding everyone else. Now, historically, we know, when did the Middle East become predominantly Arabic? Or when did it become predominantly Arabic? Because the Middle East has never been Arabic. The Arabs lived alongside everyone else. For example, Iraq and all those countries, Syria, Lebanon, Iran, you know, these countries were they were at the beginning predominantly, most people that were predominant there were mostly black and other ethnicities, including the Jews, the Persians, the Arabs, you know, other tribes lived alongside. But the Arabs under Islam wiped out every, you know, language. They wiped out every language, you know, except the Persians that are stuck. But if even they themselves are forced, you know, to pray in Arabic that they don't even understand, they don't even speak, but they are forced to pray in Arabic for religious purposes. So, now, looking at that, if we have to condemn Israel for becoming a Jewish state among 22 countries that have become Arabic, that's number one, and Islamic, that's number two. Those two factors are excluding everyone else. And no one is saying anything. But then Israel comes and say they want to become a Jewish state, and we are all out against Israel. That becomes problematic. But at the same time, we also know that Israel, in as much as it has a right to defend itself, it has gone too far, because this is no longer self-defense. This is now becoming, you know, barbaric, you know, deliberately barbaric, because Israel is now bombing indiscriminately, bombing civilians, killing almost everyone, including UN officials and, you know, international aid group officials. So both sides are committing a crime. And, you know, both sides are committing a crime. There is no side that is innocent. The Arabs are not innocent because they have destroyed everyone else. If you look at what happened 1,000 years ago, around 1,000 years ago, 400 years ago, what the Arabs, in fact, during the Islamic Crusaders, what they have done, the Arabs, you know, for example, I'm talking about them as a tribe, because there, you know, Egypt was never Islamic, and Egypt was never Arabic, but now Egypt is Arabic and Islamic. The same with Libya, you know, and this whole North African, countries. They were never Arabic. They were predominantly black societies. But all those black societies were wiped out. It was a genocide. You know, it was a genocide, the ethnic cleansing that was done in the name of religion. Where, you know, Islam, you convert to Islam or you die. That was what happened in North Africa. And in fact, they did what Faustina Domingos did in the 18th centuries in Argentina, you know, where they exterminated the black, you know, they exterminated the black population because they didn't want to have a black population in their country. It was a government policy. And it became a religious doctrine in the Middle East. Other tribes are forced to speak Arabic and they are forced to convert to Islam. So, you know, North Africa was black, but now it is Arabic. We know that Arabics are also black, but they don't consider themselves black because they are a bit, you know, when somebody is a bit, you know, light skin, they consider themselves something else. So, but even if you get to the word Mauritania, Mauritania comes from the word Mauros, which means land of the blacks. All those black, those lands were predominantly black, but today we are talking about Arabs to the point that Morocco and Tunisia, you know, their mentality, they don't even consider themselves as Africans because of their skin color, because of, you know, because they are a bit light, they think they are Europeans. Well, yeah, so, but those were the mistakes done that are those mistakes that are leading us to the problems we see today. And those problems are embedded and they've become a mentality on both Israel and, you know, other Arab countries in the Middle East. Their mentality is a war of attrition, which is a genealogical and generational war. You know, they will continue fighting until Jesus comes. So that is embedded in them. It is a crisis that has become generational. It's a genetic. It has become a genetic crisis. So we are seeing what we are seeing, but we look at it from the historical background, the mistakes that were made by the old generation that is leading the Netanyahu generation and the Khomeini generation to fight each other. So, and it will continue until, you know, Jesus comes. Now, let's go to the... Okay, now, Malema is lashing out on those that are getting involved in the xenophobic activities that are taking place in South Africa. Now, let's get a listen and then we meet the other side. We're just going to take, you know, 5 minutes of what he's saying and then we continue.
But let's ask a question. After you marched and say you don't want Zimbabweans, you don't want Nigerians, you don't want Ghanaians, you close shops, you march, why are you not coming back to tell us the following day that after that march, we expelled 10 Zimbabweans And out of those 10 Zimbabweans, we're able to give 10 South Africans jobs. There is no such a report. Why? Because now kaba kuba ma Zimbabwe, hauna misebetsi, batho ba le ba ma Zimbabwe, ba etsa misebetsi e lona le sa batleng ho etsa because those are slaves' jobs. They don't pay anything. You want proper jobs. You want a job with a pay slip, with an appointment letter, with pension, with medical aid, and you deserve it. But why are we fighting each other? It is the same people who made us fight each other during apartheid, black on black violence. They sponsored it. The same provinces where blacks were killing blacks during apartheid, sponsored by apartheid government, is the same provinces where blacks are beating blacks today. The script is the same. The writer of the script is the same. Why do you ask me? Unkupa urna, koncha mwana, koskolong kar is not South African. Ke munche koskolong, ke feche ke shebe waka, ke be proud father. After removing a black child from school, when the black children were removed from school with bullets in 1976, when our parents were removed from school because they did not have school fees, I must play that role. Me, I will never do it. I'm not going to take a pregnant woman out of a clinic because she's not South African. She gives birth of an African child at the gate, and that child dies. And you want me to do that and be proud and look at my children and say, I'm a proud father. After I stopped life, after I killed someone, I will not do that. I did not join politics to be voted for. I was too young when I joined politics. These positions that I have came as a result of my participation. I am not in politics to be elected. I'm in politics to articulate a position of African people who have been oppressed for too long. We are not saying any Zimbabwean, Nigerian, Ghanaian must bring crime here. The same way no South African must bring crime here. Anyone who brings drugs, South African or Nigerian, must be dealt with according to the laws of South Africa. Not mob justice. Le na le west, ba northwest. Le tswana le rena ko Limpopo. Ha ba qeta ka ma Zimbabwe, you must know we are next. Because bo buti shor ntweking ka seZulu ye ye. Just talk about hack. So you must stop it before it comes to you. Remember, Naba Limpopo were even too dark. They are just going to look at us and say, well, now we don't even have to ask you anything. I kupe. Are. Before it comes to us, let's stop it there and say, let's deal with illegal immigration through the laws of this country. The Minister of Home Affairs is a DA minister, but they never match the Minister of Home Affairs, who is responsible for illegal immigrants. Why? They are scared of white people. Look at them. When they speak to a white person, they are very respectful. They show manners. When they speak to a black person, they are violent. When is that march going to Cape Town? Because a lot of illegal immigrants, white immigrants, are in Cape Town. Let's see them going to Cape Town and asking whites to produce their IDs. The same way here in Northwest, a lot of whites say they own land. If you ask them to produce a title deed, they don't have. They gave each other the land early 90s when they saw that democracy was coming. So many white people are here in South Africa, illegal labor. Now, they must be treated the same way we treat others. Bona, they are even worse. They've got our land. How na le fast? Narulala economic freedom. Oshapa le Zimbabwe liata maya. You remain landless. How na le Zimbabwe le na le fast? Le fast le kama aramato amakhuwa. How na le Zimbabwe le na le factory, le na le mine, le na le bank. You are fighting.
Right, so what he's saying that the land that you don't have a land as a black person, the land is in the hands of a white person. And then you don't have factories because everything in terms of means of production is in the hands of a white person.
You, they say foreigners have taken jobs from you. Go for them. You go there. They take everything. That's what they did during apartheid. When we were supposed to get our freedom, they started a fight between ANC and IFP. Instead of concentrating on fighting for freedom, we got distracted and killed each other. Who took the weapons?
Chisho, pagyo tadi ko pasere overkara uasira yakweni ochisho. Watuchi itana basic mental health first aid course. Haiganjwa oshari chamhongi kwa mboka iri iyo yo NHP. Watapewa unongo nonseo na keneuna okutongorora omadidiriko ogopetameko igena cha nupiakadi nenge omathidakano opamadhirabiro kuchane omokatiko kumekoe nenge anironga pamwe nangoe osho otopewa unongo kene una okuya kwathera nokuya pa eabidido yiri mwanjira omanga upya kadiboka inauru darara kuyerere ounji na kene unokara uishangitha tarira po epanja yao yo nhp.com.na ehangona maradura sano ododina okurandurwa NHP rooted in care for you.
Your life, your peace of mind. NHP, we're about you.
All right, it's 7 o'clock. It is 7 o'clock right now, and we continue with our program. So Malema is saying someone is busy distracting black people. And this is not just South Africa. Of course, in South Africa, that's the only country where, you know, publicly, they come public against, you know, foreigners, mostly against their fellow Africans. But in other countries, there are forms of the, you know, xenophobia that, you know, take place. There are forms of xenophobia that take place, you know, but they are not public. They are done, you know, how do we say? They are, it's a soft kind of, you know, action. But in South Africa, they come out and they practice it publicly. Somebody apparently is behind this, according to Julius Malema.
Bought a lot of ammunition, took it to KZN. That's why till today, there are a lot of illegal guns in KZN. Those guns were delivered by the apartheid government, arming blacks to fight one another. Today, they don't give you guns. They put in your mind wrong ideas for you to hate each other, concentrate on one another, while they continue to benefit the minerals of our world. We need to focus, comrades. Nah, have a party.
Okay. So, this is what... You know, but let me also add, let me come back home. Let me come back home. Do you know that in Namibia, we waste so much time? We waste so much time on things that do not even bring our bread, do not bring bread on the table. Things that don't pay our electricity, things that don't pay our, don't buy, you know, don't recharge our phones. Those are the things that we care about. And if the government says, for example, they are going to legalize abortion, most of us will march, and it will become the talk of the day. It will become the talk of the world. We will talk about it. It becomes a topic on social media, people condemning it. But what does legalizing abortion, what does it bring into the pocket or into the wallet of a woman in Okuliangava, for example, in Havana? What does it contribute? What financial contribution does it make? So, that's a question that we need to ask ourselves before we get into the mood of talking. Because you need to ask yourself, okay, after marching against abortion, what? What do I eat from there? You know, what does it contribute? Because whoever wants to abort, you know, they are harming their own body. That's number one. Number two, they are already preparing themselves for a psychological aftermath of what they have done. That is their problem. It's not your problem. Now we come, you know, religiously and say, no, because abortion is a sin against God. Okay. If it is a sin against God, let God deal with the sin. You know, we are not God. Let God himself protest against that. And in fact, he has much capacity to do that. But we also need to understand the free will that has been given to every human being. And that free will is for you to do what you think you want to do. But, of course, knowing that whatever you do, you have consequences. So, the people know that if we focus on things that brings our bread, we will keep them on their toes. And the deep state does not want to be kept on its toes. The deep state wants to relax, and they come up with all this sort of distraction, you know, to distract you from the mate, from focusing on, you know, the things that, you know, politicians are failing. And in our next stories, of course, we will have to talk about more, you know, in as much as we can condemn to say, who is funding coups in Africa? Coups are being funded. We also need to look at the realistic side of the coin. And that's what we are going to be talking about, tying into what. But we are busy destroying each other. We are busy destroying each other, and that is done deliberately so that we focus. So, we are failing to focus on what brings bread. So, we are failing to unite as a continent. Other continents are united. Have you heard about Germans chasing away British or French, marching in the street wanting people from Poland to go? Or, you know, people in Poland marching in the street wanting people from, you know, Hungary to go? No. It only happens in Africa, where a Namibian wants a Zimbabwean to go. And the Zimbabweans... But at the same time, we also need to look at it, this way. Most foreigners, I met my brothers, and they were speaking, and they didn't know I understand the language. So, I was somewhere, and they were talking. I said, "No, Namibians are very lazy, and soon we will take over." And they were talking about, they were saying those things. So, and I went into the conversation and I said, "Look, guys, Namibians are not lazy. They are just welcoming. Imagine you saying that in South Africa. What do you think would have happened to you if somebody understands and he gives that interpretation to the next person? You were going to be rounded up, because that's already a provocation. So, you don't say that. Because especially with Namibians, we are very welcoming people, because we know we have gone through a lot. We've been in Angola. We've been in Zambia as refugees. So we know what it means to be a refugee. But sometimes our foreign brothers don't respect that. You know, they don't respect that. They take that as weakness. And they start now to do all sort of things. And those are the things that are underlying factors that could provoke a response from the locals. So, in as much as we can be distracted and to go after one another, at the same time, the mentality among our foreign brothers from other countries also need to change. Because they also need to understand they are in a country that is foreign. And it's not a right that they are here. It's a privilege. Because every country must focus on building, you know, the state for its people. This is the argument that South Africa is saying. And the local person in South Africa is saying that, no, we love our brothers and sisters, but let them go back to their country and build their countries. Let their government look after them. Because the little that the government is trying to give to us, we are sharing it with them. And mind you, under any normal circumstances, even the children in the house will have that understanding. If other parents' children are coming to our house and what was supposed to be ours, we are sharing it with them. And it now becomes systematic to the point that, you know, dad or mom is no longer able to afford, you know, you can even see that dad is even stressed now. So that will provoke one of the siblings or its children to stand up to say, no, let the parents support. Now, let me just give you a practical example. Most students that are here, that are in, you know, all universities, they are coming from where? You are coming from Mariental, coming to Windhoek. You are coming from Ruakana into Windhoek. You are coming from Katima to Windhoek to come and attend, you know, school or university. because some of the courses that you have taken are not in, you know, the campuses around the north. They are just here in Windhoek. So you came to Windhoek from the north, from wherever. But since you came in to the to your uncle's house or auntie's house, your mother's sister, your father's brother, your father or your mother never sends anything. You know, your mother or your sister does not send any contribution. You are bathing hot water every day to go to school. You are using Wi-Fi. You are using electricity. You are sleeping on the bed, which was supposed to be that bed for me who is born in the house. You are eating. So you are on 100% subsidy. You are 100% subsidized by your uncle or your aunt. Now, where do you think they are getting that money? And it's an entitlement that is in our families, that he's my brother, so he needs to take care of my child. Can my
great news? Imbert just got even better. We have added brand new features to make your experience smoother, faster, and more powerful than ever before. Ready to unlock the full potential of Imbert? Get all exclusive features for just 36 Namibian dollars a month, or save even more with our special subscription plans. 5% discount for 3 months subscription, 10% discount for 6 months subscription, and 25% discount for 12 months subscription. Choose the plan that works best for you and start enjoying everything Imba has to offer at an unbeatable price. Imba, where the world congregates. Download it and subscribe today.
So you are saying, can my child suffer? Well, John is in Windhoek. But that John had, you know, to sweat to become what he is today without your assistance. And now you feel entitled to send your child to John to take care of your child as what? Apparently as a sister. But did you contribute to John's effort to become what he is today? No. So that kind of mentality, that kind of entitlement is the one that is bringing, it's the one that is becoming an underlying factor in the xenophobic activity that is taking place in South Africa. Because a lot of foreigners are very much entitled. Because, you see, South Africa is not responsible for the failure of every state in Africa. For South Africa to be forced, you know, to be accommodating to everyone. Of course, let them deal with, of course, activities of xenophobia should be condemned by the government. Because that is now, you know, the locals taking law into their hands. But at the same time, we also need to look at the issues that are underlying factors, the behaviors of people that are in South Africa that are foreigners. Just like the behaviors of children that are in your house, that are your sister's children that have come to study in universities today. Some of them don't even do work. They are eating, they are getting their NSFAF money. Where are they putting that money? It's now becoming a problem between, you know, families, between siblings, that because now somebody's reporting to say now uncle wants our money. It's now to say uncle wants our money. When uncle is saying, please, from your NSFAF money, contribute a 500 at least for electricity every month. And now the report that is reaching your parents is that your uncles are after your money, and then it's creating a problem. So that's why some of you now are cast out of those houses you are now renting, and you are struggling because the entitlement of family is equals to is the same entitlement that, you know, foreigners that go to South Africa, even foreigners that comes, you know, the foreigners that come into Namibia have. It's not a right for you, if you're a foreigner in any country, to be in that country. It's a privilege. and you need to take it as such and behave accordingly. All right, so now we are talking about Sierra Leone. We are talking about Sierra Leone, Sierra Leone president, you know, appreciating the role that China is playing in making sure that, you know, Africans access the Chinese market, which is one of the largest markets in the world by far. So, and China has introduced a free tariff, you know, trade from between Africa and itself.
I don't know whether you noticed China's 15-5-year plan and the zero tariff treatment to Africa. For you, what do you think a strong Chinese economy could benefit Sierra Leone and African continent?
China is a great market. And I cited that instance of the fishing harbor and the certification process that we allow. But beyond that, China has made sure that products from who were friends of China could enter that market at zero cost, zero tariff. It is this sort of relationship wherein you give us access to a market of that magnitude, provided all the other criteria are met. So we are looking at a China that can grow with its friends. They are not mutually exclusive. You can grow and still carry your friends along with you. And that is where the world will become a more peaceful place.
Mr. President, if I didn't get it wrong, there's a saying in Sierra Leone said, you cannot tie a knot with just one hand. You have to use two hands, which means countries, no matter small or big, developed or developing, they have to work together to build a better future. What do you think of Chinese President Xi Jinping's vision for a all-weather China-Africa community with a shared future for the new era? What is your impression and interpretation for that?
I think earlier on I referred to a meeting at a time when we were all isolated. Everybody was thinking about their own countries. Of course, we had COVID in China at the time, but he still had time to think about a small population, less than one of the cities in China, by far. For me, we need the sort of engagement at the highest levels for us to genuinely deep dive into our problems. Sharing table with him at the dinner, he told me the best way to a successful agrarian revolution is a highway, meaning stressing the importance of infrastructure, and have come to realize that you cannot embark on agriculture at scale without paying serious attention, investing in infrastructure. So that sort of experience sharing only takes place at that level.
Okay, so, and that is, of course, the mutual. They say that the relationship between China and Africa is on mutual, you know, respect, is built on mutual respect, win-win situation, like the late president used to say. So this is the president of course, Sierra Leone. Ah, I have a problem with, you know, pronouncing that country, Sierra Leone. Do you guys remember those days when we used to be sent by teachers? You know, a teacher would say, go and get me a dictionary or an encyclopedia. Just go to the library and say, they must give you an encyclopedia. When you leave the block, the class, the blocks, because the library is in another block. On your way to the library, or, you know, library, you are repeating this word, dictionary, dictionary. And then somebody greets you on the way, maybe an institutional worker or somebody, and then immediately that word is gone. You know, by the time you reach the library, huh, is it there? Because you forgot, it's either you forget, mostly you forget the last word, nari. Then you have the diction. Diction. Huh. Is it a dictionary, direction? What is it? By the time you stand at the door, you forgot already the word completely. You have come up with a new word and you convinced yourself that's the correct word. What were you sent? Ah, I was sent a depiction. What? Yes, I came to get a depiction. Huh? What is a depiction? Until you go back with the librarian to the teacher to say, what did you send this boy? No, I sent him a dictionary. What did he tell you? He came here saying you sent him a depiction. Yeah. So those words are very difficult. They used to be very difficult for us to pronounce. And the teachers will laugh. It becomes, you know, you become a laughing stock that even those who don't even know, also, you know, learners that who don't even know how to pronounce it, they'll just be laughing at you. So, please, you can laugh at me, by, you know, Sierra Leone. Sierra Leone. I don't know whether I'm pronouncing it well, but it is Sierra Leone. Yes. That's a Sierra Leonean problem. President, talking to CGTN on how they appreciate the role that China is playing in their development. Because you cannot produce, stuff without, you know, a market. Even if you have infrastructure in place, you have correct infrastructure, you have correct, you know, human resources, you have capacity in terms of equipment and production, but you have all this, but you don't have a market, you will still not have done anything. So it's not just about having infrastructure in place. It's not about having, you know, human resources in place. It's not about having capacity in terms of the right equipment needed to have production. It's about the market. And because the market is, that's where you get the profit through. And a market such as China is a bigger market for Africa. And a market such as Africa is a bigger market for China because we are one to one. You know, Africa and China is one to one. Of course, Africa and China and an individual country, that is a little bit a different story. Because the population of Namibia could be a population of a suburb in one of the largest suburbs, maybe in China. So, now if Soweto is 2.5 million, what about Tianjin? So, what about one suburb in Beijing? It could be bigger than, you know, Soweto or in terms of population. Now, but for, you know, when we are talking about Africa as a larger block, we are one-to-one with China and one-to-one with India. So, and India can sell to Africa, and Africa, India is a bigger market for Africa, and Africa is a bigger market for India. China is a big market for Africa, and Africa is a big market for China. So having a market in China, for example, if we could even find, especially in the north, and the, you know, the eight regions of Namibia, with our Nguni, you know, type of cattle, if they can be processed in a at a level where we can have access to Chinese market, that is going to at least be big. Like we had a market for in Ghana, I don't know whether it's still, I don't know whether we are still selling meat to Ghana, but that too was a good, good initiative to at least, because our Nguni kind of cattle could not be compared with the Simbras that are in here in the south, and the kind of breed that are in the south. So, but to say we should switch and be equivalent with the south in terms of the quality of cattle, that will be impossicant, according to Nigerian English. It might be impossicant in many ways or in many aspects. What we do is let's develop what we have and add value to what we have, and then we take it from there. So, Sierra Leone is celebrating the mutual trade agreement that is between them and China. And it's not just Sierra Leone that is doing that. It is just Africa as a large. Now, let's get into our main story. Who is funding the coups that are taking place in Africa?
When it comes to managing your investments, should you rely on one expert or a team of specialists? With a multi-managed portfolio from Alex Forbes, your funds are guided by carefully selected investment experts working together to pursue more consistent outcomes. We pair the right managers behind the scenes so you don't have to manage multiple relationships. Strengthen your investment destination. Visit alexforbes.com today.
Alex Forbes Namibia is registered and regulated by NAMFISA.
All right, so after this, I will open the line so that you can come through. But this is, we are going to listen to an investigative journalist from Nigeria. His name is David Adeyene, just giving us a breakdown of what has taken place in Mali currently. And then from there, we are going to have a conversation further. And of course, don't forget, you can participate in the show. You can participate on the show. The number is in studio 083-288-401. That is the number if you want to be part of the conversation. We take it from there. Now, who is funding coups in Africa? So let's take a listen and then we meet the other side.
This past weekend, Mali was hit by a wave of coordinated terror attacks from multiple groups. And in these attacks, which targeted civilian and military infrastructure, Mali's Minister of Defense, Sadio Camara, was killed in the attacks on Sunday. Mali's government has claimed that the situation is under control and the attack has been met with strong condemnation from the Confederation of Sahel States, to which Mali is a founding member of, and the African Union as well, condemned, though notably, Zoe, Western governments have been largely silent. So what's really happening and what does it mean for the region? Joining us now to discuss is Nigerian investigative journalist David Hundeyan. David, welcome back to Breakthrough News Live.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's just jump right into it. You know, David, we're hearing that the government says things are totally under control, but these attacks were quite widespread. They were coordinated. So can you just start by walking us through what actually happened in Mali and how significant are these coordinated attacks?
Okay, so first, I guess, an explanation of the groups involved in this. So there's the Al-Qaeda affiliates, GNIM, which I think is very well known. They have a history of carrying out terror attacks across the Sahel region. And then there's this other group called the Azawad Liberation Front, the FLA. And they are essentially a separatist group. They believe that the Tuareg ethnic group in northern Mali should have their own country called the Republic of Azawad. And for the longest time, these two groups have been very much distinct. They've both carried out violence against the Malian state, but they've been distinct. Now, for the first time, in a move that is very, very reminiscent of what happened in Syria 2 years ago, these disparate groups with completely different foundational issues have all somehow coalesced. They've all come together, and they're just very suspiciously well-armed and well-resourced, and they attempted to do what was done in Syria in 2024, where these armed non-state actors actually carried out a coup against the legitimate government and replaced the government in Syria. That was what was attempted here. So they made an attempt on even the capital. This wasn't just like a terror attack. This was actually a coup attempt, because one of the signature hallmarks of a conventional coup attempt is that the coup plotters always try to take over the strategic infrastructure in the capital, such as the state broadcasting, a radio and TV station, the presidential palace, the airport. They actually tried to take control of the airport before they were pushed out. They actually got that far. So it's important to understand that this wasn't just a big terror attack. This was an attempt at a decapitation strike against the Malian state. The idea was to collapse the Malian government and to essentially either A, replace the Malian government, or if they couldn't do that, create so much chaos and panic that the Malian people will then rise up against their own government. Fortunately, unfortunately, depending on which side of the ideological fence you stand on, that didn't happen. The Malian military, in conjunction with the Africa Corps of the Russian military, who are present in Mali, were able to push these attackers out for the most part. They've regrouped in the northern area called Kidal, where there's sort of like ongoing fighting going on right now. But they've been pushed out of Bamako and Septi and all those sort of strategic areas that they were attempting to capture. Now, why the reaction to these attacks is so important is that it gives you a very clear insight into who may or may not have been involved in putting this together. Because what you'll notice is almost as soon as these attacks began, the coordinated Western media establishment response, as you said, didn't contain any sort of condemnation or any sort of indication as to the fact that this is a bad thing that is happening. This is a legitimate government that is being targeted, and these are basically terrorists, for lack of a better term. Instead, what you kept seeing was the different variations of the basic theme that the Malian government is weak, Mali is weak, and it's collapsed. So almost made it sound as if this is a terror attack and the Malian government is collapsing in the face of a terror attack. This was not a terror attack. This was a coup attempt, one of the biggest coup attempts ever attempted. There were reportedly over 12,000 fighters that were part of this wave of attacks. So if you have a terror attack where you're having 12,000 fighters, then you then have to question what kind of terror entity, what kind of terrorist group is able to mobilize resources on that scale? Because mobilizing 12,000 armed fighting men with machinery, with weapons, with all the logistical, that's quite a logistical undertaking. And to do all of that and then to go up against a nation state. To put that in perspective, Mali is geographically bigger than the UK, Germany, and France put together. It's a massive country, geographically, and you have a terrorist group that makes a credible attempt to actually try to take over such a humongous country. And then you have the Western media establishment parroting from the same crib sheet that the government of Mali is failing. Some people started spreading rumors that the Malian president had gone into hiding, which wasn't true because he came out earlier today and he gave his speech. So from my perspective, here in West Africa, it's visible to the blind and audible to the deaf what is going on. The same thing that was done in Syria, which is where different non-state actors with different grouses are sort of mobilized against the state by a Western actor, as was done in Syria. They're armed, they're trained, they're resourced, they're given access to logistics that they ordinarily cannot raise on their own. and they're used as a proxy army to collapse a state whose existence is viewed as problematic to the existence of or to the ambitions of this Western empire.
All right, before we get into the analysis of what is going on, let's just listen to OPEC, because OPEC seems to have made a decision in terms of its output in June because of the United Arab Emirates withdrawal. So let's just take a listen a little bit, then we'll come back to our story.
OPEC Plus has announced another increase in oil production in what analysts say is a move to project stability after the surprise exit of the United Arab Emirates from the group. Seven key producers, including Saudi Arabia and Russia, say they will raise their combined quota by 188,000 barrels per day in June. The alliance says the step is part of its commitment to supporting oil market stability. But despite the increase on paper, the real effect on global supply may be limited. That is because much of the group's spare capacity is in the Gulf, where exports remain constrained by the blockade of the Strait of Hormuz imposed by Iran after the outbreak of war triggered by U.S.-Israeli strikes in late February. Analysts say the latest move is aimed as much at sending a message as adding actual barrels, signaling that OPEC Plus remains in control of the market even after the UAE's withdrawal.
All right, so we will find the OPEC story. We'll look at, because now it's much very early to judge whether or not there will be consequences, immediate consequences on OPEC. People are speculating, economists are speculating on the consequences of the United Arab Emirates withdrawal from, you know, OPEC Plus and OPEC respectively. But nobody really knows the consequences yet, because now if we look at Angola, who also withdrew 2 years ago, is Angola going through some, you know, is Angola suffering consequences as a result of its withdrawal from OPEC? Well, that is, you know, arguably debatable, depending on, you know, maybe the level of understanding in terms of the economics. But I'll find an economist on the issue of OPEC, because this is not my area of specialty. Economics is not my area of specialty, so I'm not even going further. That's not how I, you know, embarrass myself in the early morning, especially when some people are listening. That's not how I put myself on the blog. But that's, you know, what happened. United Arab Emirates have pushed out, has opted to get out by the 1st of May because of what is going on in the Gulf. You know, the blockade of the Strait of Hormuz has, you know, threatened their oil, you know, export capacity. And also because of the strikes that they've gone through during the, you know, exchange between Iran, Israel, and America, when Iran decided to go after, you know, American interest in the Gulf, as countries like, you know, Qatar, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, at least those four countries where they had hit from, you know, Iranian, you know, retaliatory strikes. Going back to our stories before I open the lines, so to mobilize a 12,000 army, because this is the JINM, affiliated, you know, Al-Qaeda force with the Tuareg rebels. And, you know, funny enough, Western countries are going to the great length. In fact, it's not even a secret anymore. They've come to the level where they can even fund ISIS, or they can fund Al Qaeda, which is designated as a terrorist, you know, or a terrorist group. They've come to the point where they can even fund Al Qaeda and JINM I think it is called the Jama'a Wa'al Muslimin. So, this group is a terrorist group, according to, and it is a Western country that designates certain groups as terrorists. But at the same time, you see them funding them, you know, to remove a government they don't approve. A government that has, you know, interests that are contrary to theirs. So, and you see a coup in Africa. That was a coup because Mali and Burkina Faso and Niger, they committed a coup. They carried out a coup against France. They carried out an economic coup against France. And France wants the Malian, Nigerian, and Burkina Faso raw materials, whatever was powering their economy. France wants it back, and they can do anything to get that back. And that is, of course, what you are seeing, you know, what is happening in Mali. But the Malian forces, of course, have managed to push out the rebel, you know, force out of Bamako, and it is said that over 3,000, you know, rebel forces have been killed, or troops have been killed so far in the attempted coup. And yesterday or Saturday, there was a convoy, the convoy that was entering Mali from Mauritania, that of course was wiped out by the Russian African Corps, you know, force. That is according to the Malian government statement. Now, who is funding those coups? We know who is funding the coup, and we know that the economy of Africa does not belong to Africans. It belongs to external forces. And as much as the, as long as the economy continues to belong to, you know, these external forces, continues to interfere in African internal affairs, the so-called economic emancipation will not be achieved. It is going to be a dream. It is that dream will be, it is going to be difficult to come through. Because, you know, last year, we almost saw the destabilization of South Africa. You know, because Trump wanted to use the Afrikaners as to say that the genocide had taking place in Africa, in South Africa. How many black people, how many white people were killed? That is the question that Ramaphosa asked Trump last year. How many white people were killed in South Africa? Trump could not answer that question. And Ramaphosa was very diplomatic and very composed, very collected. And Trump was counting on Ramaphosa to make mistakes so that he can humiliate him the way he did to Zelensky. So, but compared to what Israel is doing in Gaza, if we want to know what a genocide is, we must go to Gaza and Lebanon. Israel is following the correct definition of what a genocide is, not what is going on in South Africa. You know, Gaza, since the 7th of October 2023, there are 72 up to 75,000 people that have died in Gaza. So those, in the period of 3 years, 72,000. And the community, the so-called international community is not condemning this. Now, look at the war that is taking place in Ukraine. How many civilians have died? They are saying 15,000 civilians have died so far in Ukraine. And of course, several hundreds of civilians that have died also in Russia because of Ukrainians' attack deep down inside Russia. So the minimal, the war, the fight is minimal in Ukraine as compared to what America and Israel have done in Iran, for example. They've bombed civilians. Around 2,000 civilians have been killed in just 2 weeks or so. So, that's a double standard of Western countries when they want to lecture everyone about the so-called rule-based order, which they don't follow. But the Mali situation is to teach Africa and African countries that your natural resources can be a curse to you. This is to teach Namibia that if Namibia continues to be an enemy of none and a friend to all, well, one day somebody will say, give us an oil field, and you will say no, and you'll be blown up. Very easy. Because you don't have capacity to safeguard what you have. You cannot have natural resources and be militarily weak. It doesn't add up to the equation. You know? It doesn't add up to the equation. You cannot have... Now, look at look at the embarrassing news that is now, on everyone's lips, where a naked man was found in State House. So a naked man was found in the State House, in the house. Luckily, the first family was not there. So if a naked man could penetrate and breach all security protocols, how much more if it is an armed man? So that is putting the security cluster on the line. It's an embarrassment to the security cluster. That story. Now, I don't want to care whether the story is true or false. That's not my space. But that is to show you that we are sitting on a large endowment of blessings, but we do not have the capacity to safeguard what we have. And this is also to prove to you that the Namibian foreign policy of enemy to none, friend to all, is a cowardish foreign policy. Good morning.
Morning, Frank.
Yes.
I don't know whether I'm the one to welcome you or you are the one to welcome us. Unfortunately, I don't know the structure of your program because I think it's the first time we have met. Now we are meeting here. How are you doing?
Good. How are you? Just go, please. Yes. We don't have enough. We don't have more minutes. We have few. Maybe somebody else will come in.
You see, those are some of the things because you don't know how your presentation, your storytelling presentation, lecture. Hence, we have few little time.
No,
my
policy is not to chase after callers. It is to give the analysis of the stories that I have and open the line at my discretion.
Yeah, no, I'm just talking about now how to analyze those events from the time when it's a good. These are good, very meaningful stories.
Yes,
but the way we are telling them. We are telling them the other way around.
Okay.
The opposite. Because those xenophobia that are being, those sentiments, it is because of the teaching. And there's no way, because the parents and everybody, but most of the time now you have got those now medias and those opportunities that those who have died in Kasinga have sacrificed for you. But you are still cannot documented those stories and tell them in your vernacular. I understand the piracy, whatever those pirates that
the came, piracy.
Those ones that they were, it is because of the control of the market.
But I think you are right by saying their stories were supposed to be documented in vernacular, and for example, when it comes to Kasinga, you might only have one or two ethnic groups, like most people that were majority in the fight that they were practically, that can practically tell the fight on Kasinga. You will have maybe the Ovambo people that are the majority, and then you have a lot of people from the former Kaprivi that were also in that camp. And then, so it will now become an ethnic issue. Because we are drunk when it comes to tribalism. We need to get rid of that. But telling the stories in vernacular is very profound.
Even to sustain those movies, Nigeria, just like the way it started with the Malemas and all this and that, all those speakers, presenters that you have mentioned, in the kind of Ubuntu philosophy, especially on the Malema side, I really love him. This time around, I know it's very important that. So let's tell our own story, because there's no time. What do I say now? Do I say about America or Israel and all these things? So you really need to tell us how your presentation is going to be structured from today, so that we know how to incorporate our writing and all these other things, and even our participation.
Just follow the leader. Uncle Bon.
Okay. I follow the leader. Sometimes the leader, they become dictatorship. Dictators. And when they become like that,
follow,
it's like, people.
Follow the leader. Like, just follow me. Follow me from the beginning.
We follow the leader. We follow, but lead us to the proper vision.
No, my tradition is first to present, and then if there's time, I open the line.
But now we lost track about the things that we have written. Tomorrow is another day, and then we have another topic. I understand. We follow the leader. Thank you.
All right. So my tradition is to present what I have. And after I presented what I have, then I can open the lines. Because I need you to make comments of what you have heard. Yes.
Morning, Madhya Boga.
Morning.
Nanga Madhya Boga, Sumbuga Linga?
No. It applies everywhere.
Okay. How is the morning?
The morning is good. How is it?
That's right, man. The Kasinga Day.
Yes.
Yeah, we are remembering the heroes and the heroines. For my take when it comes to this attempt, is that the African, they have to wake up. Remember when the Handa, Ben Handed, it's always like to look where you can find the what, imaginary animal, where you can see that, this one, because it's always the what, always the revenge for it. And the just revenge is toward Africa now. Remember, the Western, they lost to all when it comes to even you can see maybe even the what do you call this Western American and what the group that they have, that group is breaking down. And therefore you, they always find the imaginary people like Africa who don't think which direction they are going. They're always going to be used. And this is the way I think when American lost to all, like in Iran, they have to look somewhere to revenge that. And African, I don't think we are ready even for trying something to when they come in, okay, we can retaliate. A lot of us, we are just sleeping. And if this story what we are, because I just saw it in the social media, the person who was found in the state house, my friend, there's somebody having to lose his job. I'm telling you, if the other country were really serious, no, you cannot allow it. Things to happen like that. Just imagine, this is a person who found it naked in the state house. And then now we're wondering, where's the security? Where was our the security? And this is compromising. Seriously, how our people, how our VIP have been protected? If this is it can happen like that in the state house, where there's no error of mistake. I'm telling you, Netiopoke, we are in the big time. I think that's why sometimes if you go back, then you head out there, our army, generals, and the police, Namibian commanders, are in the pocket of that British, who see in even what? In the try. If it is, it was true, because they denied, somebody denied from army, that they are not even, it's not even my friend, but there was a picture of it in front of the media. And they're wondering now, if we are really going like this, who's really to rely on?
Ish, my friend.
Are we really protected?
Yes, thank you. Sorry for interrupting you. Yeah. I'm running out of time.
Yeah, I can tell. Yeah.
Yes. And let's so meet. You can continue on Mike's conversation with some of my stories that you can carry over. Yes. But thank you very much for calling me.
All right.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, our policy, our security architecture in Africa and SADC needs to be relooked at. The SADC Troika on Defense and Security, they need to sit down and look at what is happening in other countries as an example. If they are not learning any lesson from what is happening, then I don't know what to call it. Then it's an issue. So, I am very sensitive with other people's time, and I don't want to go beyond my time. It doesn't matter how much I still have. I'm still loaded, in fact, with, you know, much to say. But, you know, our time has come to a serious halt. We'll meet again tomorrow at the same time. Just stay tuned, and then we'll have much to talk about. We might even come and regurgitate on some of the discussions. But tomorrow we might have a guest. On we are going at, you know, the whether Namibia, you know, has a security architecture at all. Whether Namibia has a security architecture at all, because Botswana soldiers can even cross the river armed, you know, coming 20, 30 kilometers into Namibia, armed, undetected. That is what Namibia is. Friend to all, enemy to none. That policy is a policy indeed, which need to be revisited. Otherwise, one day, we will be like Maduro, you know. You wake up, you are looking at Trump's face. But anyway, till next time, let's call it a day, and let's meet again tomorrow. It's a goodbye from me. I'm going to be looking